is 1A. I'm Jen White in Washington. This year, there have been 10 federal executions, and three more are scheduled to take place before the end of next month. The last time the government executed that many people was in 1896, putting the Trump administration on track for the most federal executions in modern history. Last year, Attorney General Bill Barr announced the resumption of federal executions after a 16-year hiatus. The executions will continue right up until President-elect Joe Biden takes office. Why is the Justice Department pushing through these executions? Does it align with public opinion? And are the states using capital punishment in the same way? Here to discuss is Liliana Segura. She's a senior reporter at The Intercept covering the U.S. criminal justice system with a focus on harsh sentencing and the death penalty. Liliana, welcome to 1A.
Thanks so much for having me.
Also with us, Robert Dunham, Executive Director at the Death Penalty Information Center. That's a nonprofit organization that studies capital punishment. Robert, thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me.
So let's start with what we're seeing overall with capital punishment. Robert, what are the trends we're seeing at the state level and the federal level?
There's a long-term trend at both levels away from capital punishment, at least up until this year's executions. There were an average of more than 300 death sentences a year in the 1990s. This was going to be the sixth consecutive year of under 50, even before the pandemic. We had fewer new death sentences now this year than ever in the modern history of the death penalty.
And do we know why that's the trend?
Well, there are a number of factors. One is that evidence has grown over the course of time that the death penalty continues to be administered in an arbitrary and discriminatory way. We also have 172 documented exonerations, innocent people who were wrongly convicted and wrongly sentenced to death. And we're now seeing about one exoneration for every nine executions, which is a horrific error rate. On top of that, conservatives are beginning to say that the evidence shows that the death penalty is not a deterrent. It doesn't do what it's supposed to do, and it costs a whole lot more than a system whose harshest punishment is a long prison term or life without parole.
Well, Jordan posted on Facebook, without even getting into the racial disparity, we have evidence that the death penalty is more expensive than life without parole precisely because we have an imperfect government. I can't abide such a system empowered to kill anyone. Robert, can you explain more about the expense when we compare the death penalty to life in prison?
Sure. Most people think that the cost of the death penalty is the cost of drugs to carry out an execution, but that's simply not the case. Death penalty trials cost more, far more, than any other trial. In fact, the data shows that it costs more to charge a case as a capital case and resolve it with a plea, so you don't even go to trial, than it does to charge a case non-capitally, get a conviction, and go entirely through the appellate process. The cost also of the death penalty isn't just the cases in which the execution occurs. It's all the cases in which the death penalty is sought and not returned, all the cases in which the death penalty is sought, is returned, and is overturned, and all of the cases that result in exonerations. So you end up with a small portion of capital cases actually becoming death penalty verdicts. And once a death penalty verdict is returned, the single most likely outcome of that case is that the conviction or death sentence will be overturned. So it's a very wasteful system. It doesn't do what it aims to do for the most part. And the appellate process takes years. It's taken, in some instances, as much as 40 years, both to execute somebody and to exonerate somebody. So the length of time you're in the court system has nothing to do with the quality of review or whether you're getting it right.
Liliana, there's the federal system and then there's the state system. How do those systems work?
Well, you know, they work similarly, and I think that one of the things that has been surprising to many Americans with the return of these federal executions is that they've learned, first of all, that the federal system exists. It's important to note that Bill Barr didn't bring back the federal death penalty. I've seen that in headlines a lot. It's important that people understand that the federal death penalty never really went away. Executions were just on hiatus, so to speak. And so before, as you noted, the last execution at the federal level had been in 2003. When the death penalty returned after the 1976 landmark decision in Gregg versus Georgia, which kind of ushered in what we understand to be the modern death penalty era, so to speak, the federal government didn't reinstate the federal death penalty for many years after that. And when it finally did, it was really as part of the expansion of the war on drugs. You saw in 1988 what we kind of call the Drug Kingpin Act, which expanded the federal death penalty to apply to kind of a narrow set of crimes that were committed in the context of drug trafficking. And we saw some prosecutions under that law, but it really wasn't until the 1994 crime bill that added some 60 new crimes that were now death eligible that we see the kinds of the huge wave of new federal prosecutions. And these are carjackings, they're kidnappings, resulting in death, and there are all kinds of other crimes that previously could have been and still could be prosecuted at the state level. So the systems are actually similar in many ways, and I think more similar than I think Americans realize.
Well, one of the criticisms about this latest spate of executions is that they will take place during the president's lame duck period, the first time a president has done this in more than a century. We did get a statement from the DOJ on the timing of this decision, which says, quote, the department intended to resume executions in December 2019. However, due to litigation, the process was suspended. Once the Supreme Court ruled in favor of resuming executions, the department has proceeded each month with the exception of October since July 2020. So, Robert, it sounds like this wasn't meant to happen on the president's way out. Is this something that people had been expecting from the Trump administration?
Well, I think the people expected that the Trump administration would attempt to carry out executions. But the manner in which they have done so is so out of step with the rule of law and out of step with American history that I think you've got to take what they say with a grain of salt and look more at what their actions are. There had been no federal executions at all for 17 years. And most of that time. The reason there were no executions is because there was litigation pending in a Washington federal district court challenging the method of execution and the legality of the way in which the federal government adopted its what's called an execution protocol. That lawsuit was in place when the federal government said that we don't have drugs to carry out the executions. Let's put it on hold. At that time, the federal district court issued a briefing schedule to make sure there was an orderly way of making of checking to see that if there were going to be executions, they were going to follow the law. And what happened was the Trump administration said that it located new execution drugs in 2019. And instead of complying with the orders of the federal court, it announced its new protocol, it filed that in the court, and then it immediately issued death warrants directed at individuals who were not parties to that lawsuit, trying to get the executions to take place before the court could determine whether they were lawful. The litigation that the Department of Justice talks about is litigation to decide whether their process for implementing these new execution procedures was legal. And in fact, as we stand here today, the latest decision on the merits, actually looking at the legality or constitutionality of the federal process, the latest ruling is that this execution protocol violates federal law, especially the portion of federal law that says you cannot dispense or distribute controlled substances for anything other than an approved medical purpose without a prescription. And killing prisoners has never been an approved medical purpose. So the federal government has gone around that particular lawsuit. If it followed the rule of law and if it allowed that lawsuit to proceed in the normal course, we wouldn't have had any of these executions. So the statement that they're just moving forward with litigation done is completely misleading.
We're talking about the state of the death penalty in the U.S. and the recent string of federal executions with Liliana Segura, senior reporter at The Intercept. She covers the criminal justice system. Also with us, Robert Dunham, executive director at the Death Penalty Information Center. That's a nonprofit organization that studies capital punishment. Mark posted on Facebook, wrongful convictions happen too often. We have a police force that can't solve enough, or do they have the budget to constantly investigate? It's not like CSI where they get results in a day or two. They have backlogs, a lot of cases going on all at once. Improving the system is the only way we're going to be able to keep wrongful convictions from happening. We do have some of you with less sympathy. Carlos posted on Facebook, I don't think they were sentenced to death for being such nice guys. And Alex posted, if they killed someone, kill them. No need to give them free room and board and medical care for life. We'll be back with more from our guests and from you in a moment.
This message comes from AT&T, committed to keeping students and teachers connected. AT&T has connected over 200 million students with tools and technology for distance learning. More at att.com/remote learning.
Do you talk about the news with your friends, your family, or maybe perfect strangers? You can get all the facts you need to be up to speed on this busy news cycle on the 1A News Roundup. Find the podcast in your feed every Friday.
Abigail Disney says if she ran the family company, she'd deal with the current economic crisis very differently.
A CEO should be like a ship's captain. You know, if other people are drowning, you're the last one off the ship.
Ideas about the history and future of finding financial stability. That's on the TED Radio Hour from NPR.
I'm Jen White. This is 1A. We're discussing the recent rush of federal executions under the Trump administration. Last year, Attorney General Bill Barr announced the Trump administration would begin scheduling executions again. It was the first time the federal government had done so in 16 years. In the statement, Barr says, quote, Congress has expressly authorized the death penalty through legislation adopted by the people's representatives in both houses of Congress and signed by the president. Under administrations of both parties, the Department of Justice has sought the death penalty against the worst criminals, including these five murderers, each of whom was convicted by a jury of his peers under a full and fair proceeding. Well, let's talk about one of the cases that got a lot of attention, the case of Brandon Bernard. He was executed last week, even after pleas from former jurors. Robert, can you quickly just give us some of the details of this case?
Well, Brandon Bernard was one of five teenagers who were involved in the kidnapping, robbery, and ultimately murder of an Iowa couple who was visiting Killeen, Texas, Fort Hood, where the husband had formerly been stationed. Brandon Bernard was 18 years old. There were five African-American teenagers. He was considered to be a follower. The federal government had evidence of a pyramid chart of the hierarchy of this so-called gang, and Brandon Bernard was listed right down at the very bottom. The government had argued that Christopher Villalva had shot the couple and that Brandon Bernard had set the car on fire while the wife was still alive. Medical evidence that was not presented at the time of trial indicated that that both people were dead by the time that the fire was set. Brandon Bernard was not present and was not part of the kidnapping efforts. He was clearly a follower, and there's no evidence at all that he intended to kill anybody. What made this so controversial is that we have an 18-year-old, we have a group of teen African Americans being tried in Texas by an almost all-white jury. We have a history in the Texas state and federal courts of disproportionate use of capital punishment against defendants of color. We have a history of all sorts of stereotypical discrimination against young African-American men. And this case comes up for execution in the wake of George Floyd, in the wake of Breonna Taylor, in the wake of the racial reawakening to injustice, racial injustice in the criminal legal system in the United States. And you have misconduct on the part of the government, hiding key evidence that suggested that Brandon Bernard was a future danger when in fact they believed that he wasn't. And you have very, very poor representation by his counsel. So you've got all these different factors, racism, arbitrariness, poor representation, and the fact that you've got a teenager. All of that led a large, created a large effort to try to spare his life.
And I want to bring another voice into the conversation. Joining us now is Sister Helen Prejean, member of the Sisters of St. Joseph. She's the founder of Ministry Against the Death Penalty and the author of Dead Men Walking and River of Fire. Sister Helen, thanks for being here.
Hey, glad to be here.
So you met Brandon Bernard before his execution. What did you learn being close to him?
Well, twice, because I was working with his team that invited me in. And I have been through this many times before. I've accompanied six people to execution, mostly in southern states. And it's such an odd kind of thing because he's so alive. We also see Brandon as he's developed over 20 years and how he got along with everybody, always tried to do what his mama taught him. And here he is facing his death. And I've been with people, and how can you not be nervous as you're waiting down the days before your death? You know, human beings have imagination and consciousness and anticipate dying. But I couldn't believe how poised he was. And the more I talked to him and with the team, I could see that he had good family support. He had a deep, deep spiritual grounding. And he had such remorse. Mm-hmm. In fact, after he was killed, the morning when I woke up, one of the things I thought is at least he's past now that weight he carried every day of his life, that he had been part of something that killed two innocent people and how their family had suffered. And in fact, those were his last words. He said, "I'm sorry. I know these words sound simple to you, but they're the best words I have to tell you how I have felt from the very beginning."
Well, Brandon, as we've said, was executed for his role in the murder of Todd and Stacy Bagley, and the mother of Todd Bagley read a statement after Bernard's execution last week.
"The family of Todd Bagley would like to thank President Donald J. Trump, Attorney General William H. Barr, and the Department of Justice. Without this process, my family and I would not have the closure we needed to move on in life. It has been very difficult to wait 21 years for the sentence that was imposed by the judge and jury on those who cruelly participated in the destruction of our children to be finally completed."
We also got this email from Diana, who says, "It's not meant to be a deterrent. Capital punishment is a punishment. Public opinion should not be a factor. The only opinion that should matter is that of the victim survivors. And unless you are a victim survivor, you will never know how it feels." Sister Helen, in your work, how do you navigate that space, what the families need, and your staunch opposition to the death penalty?
Well, this is a story I told in Dead Man Walking. At first, with the first man I was with who was executed, Pat Sonier, and two teenagers had been killed, I stayed away from the murder victims' families because I thought, I'm the last person in the world they want to see. I'm the spiritual advisor to the man who killed their kids. And later I found out that was a mistake. Who wouldn't understand that when somebody is going through trauma, grief of a sudden violent death, especially of a child, but anybody you love, that their first instinct is to say, if they're approached by the government, what would you like us to do? Kill them. And what they're promised is, and she even used the word closure, we're going to have closure. But as I've worked with victims' families and gotten to know them over the years, like Bud Welch, whose daughter was killed in the Oklahoma City bombing. He came to the point of saying, even if I had watched Timothy McVeigh be executed 100 times, watched him die, when I would come home, the chair would still be empty where my daughter sat. And so it's such a bogus thing, it's a cruel thing in a way, for the government to offer this closure. When we deal with death, we have to deal with this inscrutable mystery that we have lost a loved one and that we have to deal with it. Watching the government practice violence and kill the one who killed our loved one in front of our eyes, how could that possibly heal anybody? But I understand how the victims say that. And the further part of that mother's statement was to hear Brandon say to them, "I'm sorry," really helped to heal her heart. That was the thing, I think.
Let's pause
that was
here.
The most healing of all.
Let's pause here for one moment. We're talking about the federal death penalty on 1A. We'll be back with more from our guests and from you in just a moment.
What does it take to start something from nothing? And what does it take to actually build it? I'm Guy Raz. Every week on How I Built This, I speak with founders behind some of the most inspiring companies in the world. NPR's How I Built This, listen now.
This is 1A. Now let's get back to our conversation about the Trump Justice Department's push of federal executions. We're here with Sister Helen Prejean, member of the Sisters of St. Joseph. She's also the founder of Ministry Against the Death Penalty and the author of Dead Man Walking and River of Fire. Also with us, Liliana Segura. She's a senior reporter at The Intercept. She covers the U.S. criminal justice system with a focus on harsh sentencing and the death penalty. And Robert Dunham is the executive director at the Death Penalty Information Center. It's a nonprofit organization that studies capital punishment. We got this message from MJ from Bethesda, who says, "As I always say, there are no millionaires on death row. It's a punishment for poor people and it's racist. The chance of killing even one innocent person should be enough to say, stop it." Robert, what do we know about how the death penalty intersects with race and class?
Well, and I'm going to steal one of Sister Helen's lines. Sister Helen is fond of saying that support for the death penalty is a mile wide and an inch deep, and it's called capital punishment because those without the capital get the punishment. I think that there is a very significant relationship between race and income criminal legal system in general. We issued a report in September taking a look at the history of the use of the death penalty in the United States. And what we found is that the death penalty is clearly an outgrowth of the institutions of the United States, slavery, lynching, Jim Crow segregation. And the manner in which death penalty laws evolved clearly showed that they were directed more at disfavored classes, particularly African Americans and immigrants. And that kind of pattern we've continued to see into the present. There are two levels of major levels at which discrimination currently operates in the death penalty. First, you've got to realize that everything that goes wrong in the criminal legal system tends to go wrong worse when it comes to capital punishment because of the emotional and political nature of the cases. But what we see is that cases get selected for capital prosecution with a bias towards white victims. White lives matter more. And once you get a case into the system, regardless of the race of the victim, the defendant who is most likely to be sentenced to death and most likely to be executed is a defendant of color.
Sister Helen, at the National Catholic Prayer Breakfast this year, Attorney General William Barr was honored with an award. The Catholic Church is against the death penalty. How do members of the church reconcile that?
Well, you have to understand, when you say the church, as Vatican II, our Reform Council said, the people are the church. So you have people like William Barr, as you had Antonin Scalia on the Supreme Court, a Catholic. We have a number of Catholics on the Supreme Court. And they don't see any problem with supporting the death penalty. And you have to understand, for 1,600 years, the Catholic Church in its teaching upheld the right of the state to take life. And it's going to take a while to get to the people to understand that the heart of the gospel of Jesus, which we try to follow, is forgiveness. And it's not retaliation. It's not returning hurt for hurt. But the deep down problem that has happened from the beginning is the way the Supreme Court set up the death penalty when they brought it back. And they did two impossible things where it was bound to fail. And we now have 172 wrongfully convicted people in this system. One out of every nine, for every nine people executed, one person's had to be freed. That's how broken it is. And when the Supreme Court put it back, they said it's only supposed to be for the worst of the worst murders. And just all these stories we're telling about who ended up on in Terre Haute on death row, supposedly for the worst of the worst, like Lisa Montgomery, who was tortured as a child. Only for the worst of the worst, and nobody really knows what that means. If you kill my mother, but it wasn't during a felony, it's not called the worst of the worst. So they put an impossible fuzzy criteria and coupled it with complete discretion of a prosecutor to go for the death penalty or not. If you don't have a prosecutor that goes for death, people don't die. And that's what there's such an aberration here, or highlighting the fault in the death penalty with all the Trump executions. Because they have the power to go for death, Will Barr had it, and they're going for death. And then in that discretionary power is where you have all of the bias and prejudice that comes in. So the deep South states like mine, Louisiana, we had 8 executions in 8 weeks, and you see all of the racism in it. It's almost always for a white victim, very seldom for a person of color, because it's up to the discretion of the prosecutor. And the prosecutor is a human being with political ambitions, with partially seeing ways of being able to approach things for their biases. And so you take a William Barr, call him Catholic or not, who has a bent for we're going to get these executions done under an administration that has prided itself on force, telling the policeman when you've arrested somebody, when you're putting them in the police car, it's okay to bump their head, or sends a paramilitary against the protesters of Black Lives Matter, who put out a full-page ad in the New York Times against the Central Park five young black people accused of almost killing a jogger. He has a bent toward violence. He uses violence, and he has the discretion. And that's why the thing has been broken from the start. So you bring in Catholics in it, and what I have seen is people who have a bent for the death penalty are going to quote their religious beliefs in a way that substantiates what they already believe, and they are actually summon in the God sanction that this is according to my faith and what I believe. It's a terrible atrocity.
Liliana, when we look at the fact that we are currently in a pandemic, has that had an impact on federal death penalty cases at all?
Yes, and I'm so glad you asked, because, you know, listening to Sister Helen, I think it's really, really important to remind ourselves these executions are being carried out supposedly in the interest of public safety and, as you said, you know, in the interest of protecting life. Yet I've been going to Terre Haute since the beginning. I have been outside that prison for every single one of these executions, and I cannot tell you how surreal and alarming it has been to be in the midst of a global pandemic that has increasingly put everyone involved at risk. And that's not theoretical. I mean, I was there in July right before on the eve of the first execution, news broke that one of the people who had been involved in preparations for these executions, who was a BOP employee, had tested positive for COVID. I believe that same day, the local paper, the Tribune Star, had an editorial essentially saying that no matter how you feel about this issue, these executions were being carried out in a reckless way at a time when they did not need to happen, and that it put the community at risk. What we have seen in the months since is that, as in the rest of the state of Indiana, COVID cases have been going up and up and up. And most recently, after the execution of Orlando Hall, not only did Orlando Hall's spiritual advisor test positive for COVID, but 8 of some 40 people involved on the execution team have also tested positive. So this was entirely predictable. And I want to say, although I haven't been approved as a witness, my media colleagues who have witnessed execution after execution after execution have been in a position, in some cases, where where they spent hours in these vans waiting to be taken to the execution chamber in close quarters. A number, until recently, it was my understanding that the BOP wasn't allowing journalists to bring, for example, their own N95 masks. They had to wear the masks that were provided. And when it comes to the legal teams who are representing people coming up for execution, most of them have not made the trip to Terre Haute out of, out of an interest in protecting their health. And the lawyers for Lisa Montgomery actually contracted COVID during the course of their visits with their clients. So it's had a very real impact.
We have just about a minute left here. Robert, we know this week that Attorney General Barr will be stepping down before Christmas. Very quickly, will that affect the upcoming scheduled executions? And what should we be looking from President-elect Biden, who said he's against the death penalty?
I doubt that the change at the top of the Department of Justice will affect the January executions. As for President-elect Biden, he has said during the campaign that he wants to end the federal death penalty. There are a couple of things that he can do immediately. He can cease all federal capital prosecutions. He could declare a moratorium, but since he's someone who says that he's learned from mistakes, it's clear that informal moratoria only push the can down the road and allow sprees of execution like this. The one thing that he could affirmatively do if he can't persuade Congress to abolish the federal death penalty would be to grant commutations that would clear federal death row.
Sister Helen, very briefly, if that happens, what would that mean for you and your life's work?
Well, I'm working in Louisiana. I'm working across the United States. We still have a whole 30 states that have the death penalty in place. I'm hoping this is a wake-up call for people to see how discretionary the application of the death penalty is and that we need to abolish it. So I'll continue my work. And I accompany people on death row. Manuel Ortiz in Louisiana is somebody I've been accompanying now who's on death row. One more innocent one out of the seven that company.
That's Sister Helen Prejean. She's a member of Sisters of St. Joseph, founder of Ministry Against the Death Penalty, and author of Dead Man Walking in River of Fire. Liliana Segura is a senior reporter at The Intercept, and Robert Dunham is executive director at the Death Penalty Information Center. Thanks to you all for joining us today. This conversation was produced by Michelle Harvin and edited by Barb Anguiano. To learn more about them and the rest of the team, visit the1a.org. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. I'm Jen White. Thanks for listening, and let's talk again tomorrow. This is 1A.